have, though no expert in breast disorders, had tried to cure. Not succeeding, and being pestered by the woman, he complained to the police, who took the matter up. On 17th of January, she had written him a letter, described by Pravda as a striking human document. "Be accursed, criminal violator of my body. Be accursed, sadist, practicing your foul perversions on my body. Let shame and disgrace fall on you, let terror and sorrow, weeping and anguish be yours as they have been mine, ever since, criminal professor, you made me the victim of your sexual corruption and criminal perversions. I curse you. B." A short statement was added, signed by Vyshinsky, to the effect that the section for investigating specially important cases had the matter in hand, that is, I. Shapiro, who was in fact to be Pletnev's interrogator throughout. On the day after the publication of this article, the papers were full of accounts of meetings of a whole series of medical organizations vilifying him, the Moscow Association of Doctor Therapeutists, the Medical Union, and others. The following day, the equivalent organizations from other parts of the country sent in their protests, from Kiev, Tula, Sverdlovsk, and elsewhere, denouncing the villainous doctor, the disgrace to Soviet medicine. Among the doctors speaking to, and signing, violent resolutions attacking Pletnev, one finds the names of M. Vovsi, B. Kogan, and V. Zelenin, who were, like Dr. Sharashevsky and V. N. Vinogradov, to be tortured by the MGB in 1952-1953 in a later doctor's plot. Pletnev was sentenced, in a trial which took place on 17-July 18, 1937, to 2 years imprisonment. The press said that he had confessed. And thus, crushed and dishonored, denounced by his colleagues, found guilty of a disgraceful offense, he found himself in the cells of the Lubyanka, where a still greater misfortune awaited him. Just before the present trial, Pletnev had the formal confrontation with Vyshinsky, as prosecutor, in the Lefortovo. When it was finished, Vyshinsky said to him, "I would like you to explain to me how you took to terror. It interests me psychologically." Pletnev replied that he would confirm all the lies in court, and not spoil the show, but that for now he asked to be returned to his cell, since it disgusted him to talk to Vyshinsky. Now, under Vyshinsky's questioning, he confessed his role in the murders of Kuibyshev and Gorky. He spoke of the violent threats, made by Yagoda, against me and against my family. He mentioned a connection with Dr. Nikitin, Tolstoy's favorite physician, who had been one of a number of doctors exiled some years earlier. But he said that he did not believe Nikitin to be politically minded, an honorable rebuttal of what was presumably a false charge against a distinguished colleague. Pletnev's defense lawyer, Komodov, elicited his splendid medical record. Then Vyshinsky re-examined on that, raising the assault case. Pletnev made an attempt to reject the charge, but he was borne down by Vyshinsky, now in one of his most arrogant and bullying moods. "Vyshinsky, how many years did you say was your standing as a physician?" Pletnev, 40. "Vyshinsky, you consider your standing as irreproachable?" Pletnev, "Vyshinsky, Pletnev, Vyshinsky. Pletnev, Vyshinsky. Pletnev, Vyshinsky. Pletnev, Vyshinsky, Pletnev, Vyshinsky, Pletnev, Vyshinsky, Pletnev, Vyshinsky, Pletnev, Vyshinsky." Pletnev. "Yes, I do." "Irreproachable?" "Yes, I think so." "During these 40 years you have never committed any crime in connection with your profession?" "You are aware of one." "I am asking you because you state that your work for 40 years was irreproachable." "Yes, but since I denied that time, do you think that the sentence in the case which is well known to you, the case of an outrage which you committed against a woman patient, is a blot on your reputation?" "The sentence, yes." "Is that sentence a blot on your reputation or not?" "It is." "So there were moments of disgrace during these 40 years?" "Yes." "Did you not plead guilty to anything?" "I cannot say that I did not plead guilty to anything." "So you did plead guilty to something?" "Yes." "Is this a blot on your reputation?" "Yes." Kozakov, the remaining doctor, confirmed his part in Menzinsky's. Vyshinsky. Death. But at the end of his evidence, he defended his method and asserted that lysates could after all not have harmed Menzinsky. "For what purpose did you introduce these lysates? To kill Menzinsky?" Kozakov, no reply. Vyshinsky, did you introduce the lysates for this end? Were you certain that they would assist your crimes? Kozakov, you see, lysates have a dual effect. Vyshinsky, you dare to assert that these lysates were harmless for Menzinsky? Kozakov, yes. These three lysates were harmless. Vyshinsky, and could you have fooled Yagoda? Kozakov, no reply. Vyshinsky, In view of the impossibility of getting a direct answer to this clear question, I request the court to adjourn the session and to make it possible for the Commission of Experts to answer. 176. The questions I have put to Kozakov. After a half-hour adjournment, the Commission of Experts supported Vyshinsky's view of the matter. Such a combination of methods of treatment could not but lead to the exhaustion of the heart muscles of the patient V.R. Menzinsky, and thereby to the acceleration of his death. Moscow, Expert Witnesses. 9th of March Professor D.A. Berman, Scientist of Merit. 1938 Professor René Sharashevsky, Scientist of Merit. Professor V.N. Vinogradov Professor D.N. Rossisky V.D. Zapalov, Doctor of Medicine. Vyshinsky then read out admissions made by Kozakov at the preliminary investigation. Under these pressures, Kozakov finally confirmed his guilt in the matter. Vyshinsky was then finally able to say, "Inasmuch as we have a definite finding from the Commission of Experts, and Kozakov has repudiated his statement about the neutrality of these lysates, I think that the question can be considered closed." The last accused, Maximov Dikovsky, was then examined. He admitted having been placed in Kuibyshev's secretariat by Yanukitsa, and explained how he had helped the medical killers to dispose of Kuibyshev. Vyshinsky then produced a medical witness, Dr. Belostitsky, who had been present during Gorky's last illness and now testified against Pletnev and Levin. The final report of the expert commission, confirming all the medical accusations and the attempt on Nijolf's health, was then presented. It will be seen that the evidence in the case of these medical murders is confused and incomplete. We can be sure that those on trial were innocent of all the charges of treason, conspiracy, espionage, and sabotage. We can be virtually certain, on the other hand, that Yagoda's responsibility for the murder of Kirov was correctly established, with the minor amendment that his instructions were received not from Yanukitsa but from Stalin. But with the murky tale of the deaths of Menzinsky, Peshkov, Kuibyshev, and Gorky, we are on different ground. There are two problems: were they murdered? And, if so, were they murdered by the doctors, or by one or any of them? The first point to establish is that reliance on the binding force of the Hippocratic Oath will not take us far. Either the five doctors, Levin, Pletnev, Kozakov, A. Vinogradov, and Khodorkovsky, were guilty as charged, or the five doctors on the expert commission, and the witness Dr. Belostitsky, were, in their capacity as doctors, accomplices in judicial murder. A similar pattern was to be repeated in 1952, 1953. In the later doctors' plot, either the doctors, or some of them, procured the murder of Zhdanov, and in this atmosphere the fact of their rehabilitation by a political group not wishing the matter to go further by no means disproves this possibility, or Dr. Timashuk, their denouncer, was actively willing to have her colleagues submitted to torture and death, and the new commission of medical experts who certified that the doctors were guilty, and were afterward censured for having doing so, were accomplices in an action which would ordinarily have led to the liquidation of their colleagues. In neither case can the doctors be blamed, as can the true instigators. On the contrary, the degradation of a humane profession under political terror makes the story even more revolting. Doctors A. Vinogradov and Khodorkovsky, dead in unknown circumstances in the hands of the secret police, Doctors Levin and Kozakov, shot to death in the cellars of the Lubyanka, and Professor Pletnev, killed later, did not commit all or any of the crimes they were charged with. They may all seem to us to have been, in a way, martyrs, the unknown, confused, and pathetic martyrdom suffered by ordinary people caught up more or less accidentally in maneuvers of power by leaders to whom human life and standards of truth counted for nothing. A number of other doctors were implicated in one way or another, though not publicly, in the Gorky affair, and were known in imprisonment as Gorkyists. For example, Professor G. M. Danishevsky, chairman of the Scientific Council of the People's Commissariat of Health, and a doctor. 179. Loewenstein were reported in the Pokora and Yurtsevo camps, respectively. The argument that no post-Kirov murders in fact took place is a simple one. Stalin needed a few more assassinations to lay at the door of the oppositionists, and could only produce them by representing natural deaths as murders. This is a perfectly sound point as far as it goes. But it is an entirely negative one, and does not enable us to pronounce one way or the other, meaning no more than if the deaths were natural, Stalin might have produced an identical story. The equally general argument on the other side is equally strong, that Kuibyshev and Gorky were obstacles to Stalin, and we all know what Stalin did to obstacles. Nor is it in the least out of character to suppose that he and Yagoda would have been prepared to use the method of murder, if available. We must turn, rather, to the details. In the first place, there is Yagoda's evidence of the morning of 8th of March, When he pleaded guilty to the murders of Kuibyshev and Gorky, and not guilty to those of Peshkov and Menzinsky. On the whole, Yagoda's initial evidence seems to have been true, or as true as was possible in the circumstances, on most other matters. His account of the Kirov murder seems quite authentic, except on the point of who instructed him to carry it out, and even that is hinted at in his remarks that it was not quite like that, when describing the relevant meetings, for this can best be taken as implying that someone's name has been left out or wrongly reported. Again, he pleaded not guilty to the charge of espionage, and there is no doubt that this was the truth. So when we come to his anomalous pleas on the four medical murders, there is at least some ground for paying attention to what he is saying. On the Menzinsky case, we have the added detail of Kozakov's last-minute retraction of the whole essence of his evidence. This seems decisive. Menzinsky was almost certainly not murdered by his doctors. He may, of course, have been killed in some other fashion. On Peshkov, on the face of it, the whole idea of his murder seems almost pointless. Yagoda justly remarked, "I see no sense in his murder." That Peshkova was Yagoda's mistress really adds little to his motive. He did not propose to marry her, he was married already and made no attempt to murder or divorce his wife over the following 3 years. Moreover, the murder method, reflected in the death of the loyal old sheep and animal farm, is a trifle unconvincing. With Kuibyshev and Gorky, though, that is, precisely the two killings Yagoda freely admitted to, we have cases in which Stalin had definite and pressing political motives for murder. This does not prove that he killed them. In Kuibyshev's case, all we can say is that he is now named as one of Stalin's three main opponents of the purge in the Politburo, and that Stalin procured the death of both the others, Kirov and Orjonikidze, by devious, though differing, means, the latter by a faked heart attack. So Kuibyshev's heart attack is not by any means to be accepted simply at face value. Moreover, his survival through 1935 might have constituted a severe obstacle to Stalin's plans, and he died at precisely the time Stalin was turning against the other main opponents of the killing of Zinoviev and Kamenev. But as against that, we have no positive evidence of murder. We can, indeed, exculpate the doctors. If Kuibyshev was murdered, it was not done by them. On Kuibyshev's death, documents now published in the Soviet Union showed that he did indeed suffer from heart trouble and that, feeling very poorly, he asked to be excused from a session of Gosplan, on which the writer comments, "It is probable that this was a regular heart attack." But it has recently been speculated in a Soviet periodical that Stalin may indeed have killed Kuibyshev. Trademark. Gorky's death is the most interesting and important. For here we have a case where the survival of a sick man for a few months might have gravely hampered Stalin's plans for the August 1936 trial, whose postponement until after the holidays could perhaps have led to resistance in the Politburo and Central Committee. But how could Gorky be silenced, apart from the international scandal of arrest? As Vyshinsky put it, though with different intent, in his concluding speech, how in our country, in the conditions that exist in the Soviet state, could it be made impossible for Gorky to display political activity except by taking his life? But again, it is clear that the doctors, or at any rate those tried, were innocent. Even such credulous observers as Walter Duranty strongly doubted their guilt. A possible alternative is perhaps that Gorky was indeed murdered, but not by Pletnev and Levin, now long since rehabilitated. As I write, in 1989, opinion is still current in Moscow that Stalin procured Gorky's death. Such talk goes back a long way. For example, a Gorkyist doctor in one of the Vorkuta camps, wrongly identified as Pletnev, told a confidant in the early 1950s that Gorky had been given poisoned sweetmeats, which also killed one of his attendants. As evidence, this does not amount to much. However, there is one piece of more cogent testimony. In the summer of 1963, an old American acquaintance of Gorky visited his 86-year-old widow, Ekaterina Peshkova, in Moscow. Of her son's death, she said quite calmly that she had no doubt that it was natural. When the visitor remarked that people now said that Gorky's, too, had been natural, she became very agitated and exclaimed, "It's not quite so, but don't ask me to tell you about it. I won't be able to sleep a wink for 3 days and nights if I tell you." Madame Peshkova's evident conviction that Peshkov's death was natural and Gorky's not fits in with Yagoda's testimony in court. As with his evidence on the Kirov case, we seem to be driven to the ironic conclusion that, alone among the accused, the story told by the ex-police chief was essentially true. And if this is so, his confession to the Kuibyshev murder, alone among the other three, is best explicable as indicating that Kuibyshev, too, was really murdered. But this is a matter of deduction rather than evidence. We cannot at present at all exclude the possibility that the timely death of these men Stalin wanted out of the way was, after all, natural. Nor does it seem very probable that more will be forthcoming even when the Soviet archives are opened up. For it is rather unlikely that plans for this style of killing are committed to paper. And there we must leave this murky and horrible episode. When the doctors and their organizers and accomplices had been dealt with, the expert commission, as we have said, made its report, confirming their guilt, and for full measure establishing the damage to Yazhov's health, evidenced in his urine. Apart from a short session in camera at Wichita, it was announced, fully admitted organizing the murder of Comrade M. A. Peshkov, the hearing was concluded. But before adjournment, Vyshinsky recalled Rosengoltz for one petty smear. He described the good luck token found in Rosengoltz's pocket, see here, and asked the court's permission to read it. In a sneering tone, amid titters from the audience, he read out 8 verses of the Psalms, "Let God arise, and let his enemies be scattered," and then asked Rosengoltz, "How did this get into your pocket?" Rosengoltz, "My wife put it in my pocket one day before I went to work. She said it was for good luck." Vyshinsky continued on a humorous note, "And you carried this good luck in your hip pocket for several months?" Rosengoltz, "I did not even pay attention." Chinsky, "Nevertheless, you saw what your wife was doing?" Rosengoltz, "I was in a hurry." Chinsky, "But you were told that this was a family talisman for good luck?" At this, he winked at the crowd, which roared with laughter, and the hearings were at an end. The last act. The court reassembled on 11th of March for the final speeches and pleas. Vyshinsky's speech for the prosecution lasted all morning. He started with a violent hearing. "It is not for the first time that the Supreme Court of our country is examining a case involving the gravest crimes directed against the well-being of our country, against our socialist fatherland, the fatherland of the working people of the whole world. But I will hardly be mistaken if I say that this is the first time that our court has had to examine a case like this, to examine a case of such crimes and such foul deeds as those that have passed at this trial before your eyes, before the eyes of the whole world, a case of such criminals as those you now see in the prisoner's dock. With every day and hour that passed, as the court investigation on the present case proceeded, it brought to light even more of the horror of the chain of shameful, unparalleled, monstrous crimes committed by the accused, the entire abominable chain of heinous deeds before which the base deeds of the most inveterate, vile, unbridled and despicable criminals fade and grow dim." He then came to the whole crux, from the point of view of Stalinist logic. "The historical significance of this trial consists before all in the fact that at this trial it has been shown, proved and established with exceptional scrupulousness and exactitude that the rights, Trotskyites, Mensheviks, socialist revolutionaries, bourgeois nationalists, and so on and so forth, are nothing other than a gang of murderers, spies, diversionists and wreckers, without any principles or ideals. The Trotskyites and Bukharinites, that is to say, the Bloc of Rights and Trotskyites, the leading lights of which are now in the prisoner's dock, is not a political party, a political tendency, but a band of felonious criminals, and not simply felonious criminals, but of criminals who have sold themselves to enemy intelligence services, criminals whom even ordinary felons treat as the basest, the lowest, the most contemptible, the most depraved of the depraved." Interrupting his argument with remarks about a foul-smelling heap of human garbage, he traced the continuity of counter-revolution back to the Shakhta and Industrial Party trials. Attacking the entire past careers of Bukharin and the others, he rehearsed their current crimes. Of Zelensky, for example, he said, "I shall refer here to the most abominable practice of mixing glass and nails with foodstuffs, butter in particular, which hit at the most vital interests, the health and lives of our population. Glass and nails and butter. This is so monstrous a crime that, in my opinion, all other crimes of the kind pale before it." He went on to explain, "In our country, rich in resources of all kinds, there could not have been and cannot be a situation in which a shortage of any product should exist. It is now clear why there are interruptions of supplies here and there, why, with our riches and abundance of products, there is a shortage first of one thing, then of another. It is these traders who are responsible for it." A method of explaining economic failure which any government might envy. He attacked the line taken by Bukharin, the damnable cross of a fox and a swine in Rykov. The former wanted to prove here that, actually speaking, he did not favor the defeat of the USSR, that he did not favor espionage, nor wrecking, nor diversive activities, because in general he was not supposed to have any connection with these practical matters, for he was the theoretician, a man who occupied himself with the problematics of universal questions. Plus, He was particularly incensed with the refusal of Bukharin and Rykov to accept responsibility for the Kirov murder. Why did people who had organized espionage, who had organized insurrectionary movements and terrorist acts, and who, on their own admission, had received instructions from Trotsky on terrorism, suddenly, in 1934, stand aloof from the assassination of one of the greatest comrades in arms of Stalin, one of the most prominent leaders of the party and the government? Bukharin and Rykov have admitted that the assassination of leaders of the party and the government, of members of the political bureau, was part of their plans. Why should we assume that, having entered into negotiations with Semyonov for the organization of the assassination of members of the political bureau, Bukharin deletes from this list of persons who are to be slain one of the most influential members of the political bureau who had distinguished himself by his irreconcilable fight against the Trotskyites, Zinovievites and Bukharinites? Where is the logic in such behavior? There is no logic in it. Finally, Rykov admitted that in 1934 he instructed Artemenko to keep a watch on the automobiles of members of the government. For what purpose? For terrorist purposes. Rykov was organizing the assassination of members of our government, of members of the political bureau. Why should Rykov make an exception in the case of Sergei Mironovich Kirov, who nevertheless was assassinated on the decision of this accursed bloc? He made no such exception. In the medical murders, too, Vyshinsky pointed out that Bukharin admitted everything but actual knowledge or responsibility, dismissing an opinion current among criminologists that in order to establish complicity it is necessary to establish common agreement and an intent on the part of each of the criminals, of the accomplices, for each of the crimes. He demanded the death penalty for all except Rakovsky and Besenov. He concluded that the others must be shot like dirty dogs. Our people are demanding one thing: crush the accursed reptile. Time will pass. The graves of the hateful traitors will grow over with weeds and thistles. Over the road cleared of the last scum and filth of the past, we, our people, with our beloved leader and teacher, the great Stalin, at our head will march as before onwards and onwards, towards communism. In the evening, the doctor's defense lawyers made their pleas, putting the blame on Yagoda. Then came the last pleas of the accused. Besenov remarked that he had loyally returned to Moscow from abroad even when under suspicion. Most of the others simply accused themselves, Bukharin, and Rykov. Ivanov put in the remark, a sinister foreshadowing of future cases. The reason, I think, why Bukharin has not told the whole truth here is because throughout the whole period of the revolution he has fought the revolution and to this day has remained its enemy, and because he wants to preserve those remnants of the hostile forces which are still lurking in their dens. Krestinsky went into his splendid record in the party, starting as an 18-year-old boy in 1901, his leadership in Bolshevik underground organizations, his many arrests, his work as Lenin's organizational assistant. He made the telling point: I consider it necessary to stress the fact that I had absolutely no knowledge of the terrorist acts enumerated in the second section of the indictment, and that I learned about them only when I was handed a copy of the indictment, and went on to explain his retraction as due in part to the fact that it seemed to me easier to die than to give the world the idea that I was even a remote accessory to the murder of Gorky, about which I actually knew nothing. Rykov, trembling and livid, made a sound defense. He admitted his general guilt, and then added, but the state prosecutor has charged me with something in which I had no direct part, and which I cannot admit. He has charged me with adopting a decision, or with giving directions for the murder of Kirov, Kuibyshev, Menzinsky, Gorky, and Peshkov. The evidence brought against me in this connection has been set forth here in detail. It is based upon the statements of Yagoda, who refers to Yanukitsa. Nothing more incriminating was brought against me at the trial. The assassination of Kirov has formed the subject of two trials. Both the direct perpetrators and the organizers and leaders of this assassination have appeared in court. I do not recall that my name was mentioned then. He went on to rub in one extremely telling point. When it came to the alleged attempt on Lenin of 20 years previously, the prosecution had produced eyewitnesses, there were confrontations, and in fact direct evidence. Why then, on the question of my participation in the assassination of five most important political figures, should a decision be taken on the basis of indirect evidence? This, it seems to me, would be incorrect. At any rate, I deny any charge of my participation in these five assassinations. Until his arrest, he had believed that Gorky had died a natural death. It was only at the trial itself that he had first learned of such members of our counter-revolutionary organization as Ivanov. He concluded with a formal plea of guilty: this responsibility of mine of course transcends all the discrepancies which still remain regarding certain facts and certain details and called on any surviving rightists to disarm Rakovsky said. I confess to all my crimes. What would it matter for the substance of the case if I should attempt to establish here before you the fact that I learned of many of the crimes, and of the most appalling crimes of the Bloc of Rights and Trotskyites here in court, and that it was here that I first met some of the participants? He went on to denounce Trotsky and Trotskyism, and to point out that his evidence had been entirely satisfactory to the prosecution. Rosengoltz rehearsed his revolutionary past, starting when, as a child of 10, he had hidden illegal literature. He made a reference to his children, and then ended by unexpectedly beginning to sing a well-known song about the USSR, "I don't know any other country where we can breathe so freely." The NKVD men in the audience are reported jumping to their feet in case their intervention was needed. But Rosengoltz then broke down and resumed his seat. Yagoda, too, in low fear-ridden tones, trademark dwelt on his underground work for the party, from the age of 14, and of such later services as vast construction jobs, the canals, that is, the forced labor projects. He continued to oppose Vyshinsky on one point. I am not a spy and have not been one. I think that in the definition of a spy or espionage we will not differ. But a fact is a fact. I had no direct connections with abroad, there are no instances of my directly handing over any information. I am not jesting when I say that if I had been a spy, dozens of countries could have closed down their intelligence services, there would have been no need for them to maintain such a mass of spies as have now been caught in the Soviet Union. The doctors and secretaries pleaded Yagoda's threats to them. Levin lapsed by referring to his great esteem for Gorky, and had to be called to order for blasphemy. Pletnev mentioned his medical work, adding that the NKVD had given him facilities to write a monograph, he had known nothing of the Bloc. Bulanov criticized his fellow accused. I think, perhaps I am mistaken, that some of them showed signs of wanting to deceive the party even now, although each of them invariably began by saying that he fully and entirely shares responsibility, pleads guilty and is answerable. But this was a matter of form, general declarations. In a number of cases they tried to deny their guilt by pleading ignorance of some point. Tilde degree. Bukharin's speech, even more than Rykov's, was a brilliant development of the line he had taken throughout. He admitted leadership of the Bloc of Rights and Trotskyites, and accepted political responsibility for all the crimes. For instance, I admit that I am responsible both politically and legally for the defeatist orientation, for it did dominate in the Bloc of Rights and Trotskyites, although I affirm that personally I did not hold this position. I further consider myself responsible both politically and legally for wrecking activities, although I personally do not remember having given directions about wrecking activities. I did not talk about this. I once spoke positively on this subject to Grinko. Even in my testimony I mentioned that I had once told Roddick that I consider this method of struggle as not very expedient. Yet Citizen the state prosecutor makes me out to be a leader of the wrecking activities. As Bukharin destroyed the prosecution case against him, Vyshinsky, powerless to intervene, sat uneasily in his place, looking embarrassed and yawning ostentatiously. While accepting group responsibility, Bukharin went on to deny that the group, as apart from the central block of politicians, existed. Citizen the prosecutor explained in the speech for the prosecution that the members of a gang of brigands might commit robberies in different places, but that they would nevertheless be responsible for each other. That is true, but in order to be a gang the members of the gang of brigands must know each other and be in more or less close contact with each other. Yet I first learnt the name of Sharangovich from the indictment, and I first saw him here in court. It was here that I first learned about the existence of Maximov. I have never been acquainted with Pletnev, I have never been acquainted with Kozakov, I have never spoken about counter-revolutionary matters with Rosengoltz, I have never spoken about it to Zelensky, I have never in my life spoken to Bulanov, and so on. Incidentally, even the prosecutor did not ask me a single question about these people. Consequently, the accused in this doc are not a group. Trademark. The Bloc had supposedly been formed in 1928, long before Hitler came to power. How then can it be asserted that the Bloc was organized on the instructions of fascist intelligence services? On espionage he took the same line, Citizen the prosecutor asserts that I was one of the major organizers of espionage, on a par with Rykov. What are the proofs? The testimony of Sharangovich, of whose existence I had not even heard until I read the indictment. The prosecution had proved that he had met Kozaev and discussed politics, and taken this as proof of espionage contact. There was no logic here. He went on similarly to categorically deny my complicity in the assassination of Kirov, Menzinsky, Kuibyshev, Gorky, and Maxim Peshkov, trademark and in the 1918 case with Lenin. As to the plan of physical extermination, I categorically deny it, and hear the logic to which citizen the state prosecutor referred, namely, that forcible arrest implied physical extermination, will not help in the least. The Constituent Assembly was arrested, but nobody suffered physically. We arrested the faction of the left socialist revolutionaries, yet not a single man of them suffered physically. The left socialist revolutionaries arrested Dzerzhinsky, yet he did not suffer 212 physically. He then remarked tellingly, the confession of the accused is a medieval principle of jurisprudence. Vyshinsky flushed at the words. Thus Bukharin refuted the charges in detail. But he admitted them in general. He had been a counter-revolutionary conspirator in a stinking underground life. He had degenerated into an enemy of socialism. He attacked Western commentators who had suggested that the confessions were not voluntary, and rejected the sympathy to be expected from Western socialists. He was guilty of treason, the organization of kulak uprisings, the preparation of, unspecified, terrorist acts. He hoped that his execution would be the last severe lesson to those who had wavered in their support of the USSR and its leadership. At 9:25 p.m. on 12th of March the court retired. It returned and pronounced verdict at 4 a.m. on 13th of March. All the accused were found guilty on all charges. All were sentenced to death except for Pletnev, who got 25 years, Rakovsky, 20 years, and Besenov, 15 years. Pletnev was resentenced, this time to death, on September 8, 1941, and was shot on September 11, 1941, as were Rakovsky and Besenov. Besenov's liquidation is reported to have occurred in Oral Prison, where Spiridonova was also executed at this time, and perhaps it was there that this final winding up of the Bukharin trial took place. An old Bolshevik remarked that apart from the use of relatives as hostages, he saw the 1938 confessions as based on total lack of political hope. In addition, in spite of everything, Stalin had continued his promise not to execute the Bukharinites. They knew he had gone back on his word in most other cases, but a little hope goes a long way in such circumstances. Bukharin, nevertheless, must have known that his own attitude in court, fulfilling the minimum requirements only, would cost him his life. He had said in court that he was almost certain he would be dead after the trial. He and Rykov, unlike Zinoviev and Kamenev, were ready for death. They are said to have died firmly defying their captors. In 1965, Bukharin's last letter was published in the West. This was at a time when there was talk of an official rehabilitation of Bukharin and Rykov. And, in fact, they had at least been exculpated of spying and terrorism, though only at a fairly obscure conference of historians. And Ikhramov, Krestinsky, Zelensky, Kotzaev, and Grinko had actually been rehabilitated, making nonsense of the charges against the rest. However, full rehabilitation of the two principals did not come for another 23 years. The last letter appeals to future leaders of the party and denounces the NKVD and its use of the pathological suspiciousness of Stalin. This hellish machine can transform any party member into a terrorist or spy. He was not guilty, would cheerfully have died for Lenin, loved Kirov, and had done nothing against Stalin. He had no connection with Ryutin's or Oglanov's illegal struggle. Bukharin's wife, Anna Larina, was arrested soon after the trial. She is reported spending 6 months in a small cell permanently ankle-deep in cold water, but survived to serve 18 years in labor camp and exile. Their small son was brought up by Anna's sister and for 20 years knew nothing of his parenthood. It was Anna Larina who, in the final days before Bukharin's arrest, had learned his letter by heart. It was finally published in Moscow in 1988. Bukharin's crippled first wife, Nadezhda, had written to Stalin several times asserting his innocence, and turned in her party card after his arrest. She was arrested in April 1938, and her surgical corset taken from her so that she was in continual pain. However, she refused to confess. She was interrogated at intervals until March 1940, when she was shot. Her brothers, brother-in-law, and other relatives were also arrested and were shot, died in prison, or disappeared in camps. Bukharin's daughter by his second marriage, Svetlana, had been left at liberty when he was arrested. At the end of the year, she was encouraged to write and sketch for an article in Pionerskaya Pravda, which appeared on December 28, 1937. She later interpreted this as being a method of showing her father that the family was not being persecuted, but that if he gave further trouble, this unspoken bargain might be changed. She and her mother, in fact, were not arrested until later. She herself was convicted without an indictment, is adequately convicted in being Bukharin's daughter. Ikhramov's wife and his four brothers were shot, and his elder son was arrested. Ikhramov himself was informed of all this while in jail. His younger son, Kamil, 10 years old at the time of the trial, was only arrested in 1943. Yagoda's wife is reported in camp, though she was eventually shot, while two sisters and his mother seem to have died in camps as well. Tilda Ivanovs. 224. Wife is reported in camp, and the wives of Rakovsky and Osinsky in the Butyrka. Rykov's wife was also in the Butyrka, in 1937, anxious and ignorant of her husband's fate. She did not survive, and their daughter was sentenced to 8 years in camp to be used only for general labor, and in the event served 20 years. During 1938 at least, Bukharin's father and Rosen Goltz's wife are said not even to have been arrested, as for the family of Tomsky, who had sensibly predeceased the other conspirators, his two elder sons were arrested and shot, his wife and youngest son were imprisoned. During the whole period of the trial, from the announcement on February 28, 1938 that it would take place until the actual executions, the papers had, of course, been full of the demands of workers' meetings that no pity be shown to the foul band of murderers and spies. Leaders and articles rubbed it in. A conference on physiological problems at the Academy of Sciences passed a resolution of thanks to the NKVD. The folk poet Jambul produced his usual verse contribution to Pravda. Annihilate. The verdict of the court was received with many expressions of public joy. Life, which had cast the Bukharin reactionaries aside, was represented mainly by the heroes of the Soviet Arctic expedition who had been landed at the pole some months earlier and were now in the news. There was celebration first of their rescue from the ice floe and then, on 16th of March, of their arrival back in Leningrad on the icebreakers Yermak and Myrmanets. Papanin and his gallant comrades were, as before, given the full treatment day after day, with receptions, decorations, public meetings, and a vast press spread. A further sign of the rejection by the forward-looking Soviet people of all the dark forces of the past was shown in the elections to Union Republic Supreme Soviets. As Stalin was to remark so tellingly in his report to the 18th Congress in 1939, the executions of Tukhachevsky and Yakir were followed by the elections to the Supreme Soviet of the USSR, giving the Soviet power 98.6% of all taking part in the voting. At the beginning of 1938, Rosen Goltz, Rykov, Bukharin and others had been sentenced, and after this, elections to the Supreme Soviets of the Union Republics gave the Soviet power 99.4% of all taking part in the voting. As for the effects of the trial, once again neither the ineptitudes of the plot nor the partial denials of the accused made any difference. The extravagances included those long since established. Once more, a vast network of assassins was discovered. At least 8 groups were working on the destruction of Stalin: Molotov, Kaganovich, Voroshilov, and Yazhov. And, this time, they were shown not simply to be under the protection of high officials in the party and the army, but actually to have been nourished and sponsored by the NKVD itself. Seldom can terrorists have had such advantages as those supposedly enjoyed by the plotters. Apart from half a dozen members of the government, including the head of the secret police itself, they actually had on their side the NKVD officers Paukar and Volovich, responsible for guarding their prospective victims. But the results had been negligible. Assassinations had indeed been carried out, but only by doctors. By adding these in, the total successes of all the groups of assassins exposed at the 3 trials consisted of Kirov killed, Molotov perhaps slightly shaken in a car accident, Kuibyshev, Gorky, and Menzinsky poisoned by their doctors, and Gorky's son given a chill and then doctored to death. It is an unimpressive result, and the conclusion, that the best way to assassinate anyone was to wait until he got ill, was not very encouraging to anyone desiring speedy action. A minor curiosity, again unnoticed by enthusiasts, is that the indictment cites against the accused diversionary acts in the Far Eastern Territory, and in particular certain specified train wrecks, on the instructions of Japanese intelligence, and the verdict finds them guilty of this, but no attempt at all is made to prove it in the evidence. The reason for this anomaly is not clear, though it might conceivably be that the relevant witness balked at the last moment. Another oddity of the trial was again the implication of a whole series of important figures who were, however, not produced. As Grinko had remarked, the block included a number of other people who are not now in the dock. Major roles in the conspiracy, as important as those played by any of those appearing in court, were alleged to have been played by Yanukidze, Rudzutak, and Anipov, while A.P. Smirnov, Karakhan, Uglanov, V. Schmidt, and Yakovlev had roles notably more important than the second level of those appearing in the dock. Registered Yanukidze and Karakhan had indeed been shot without public trial. But why? And as to the others, why did they not appear? Such questions were scarcely asked. On an even more essential point, Bukharin's calculation that his tactics would adequately expose the falsity of the charges against him seems to have been too subtle. It was, of course, plain that he denied all overt acts of terrorism and espionage. But who is affected by this? Serious independent observers in any case did not credit the charges, and would not have done so even if he had confessed to all of them, any more than they did in the case of Zinoviev. But to the greater political audience for whom the trials were enacted, the impression received was simply that Bukharin had confessed. For those who even noted that the confession had only been partial, the fact that he had admitted to organizing a terrorist conspiracy outweighed his rejection of actual terrorist acts. Indeed, this last even gave a certain color to Vyshinsky's thesis that Bukharin, though driven to admit the essentials, was trying to wriggle out of particular crimes. Stalin had once again won the battle of wits. For he understood, as the intellectual Bukharin did not, that political effects did not depend on simple logic, just as, in the 1920s, his opponents had won the arguments at congresses in the debating point sense, without affecting his practical victory. All the accused except Yagoda were rehabilitated in 1988. 13. The foreign element. The NKVD organs could extend the category of enemy of the people to everyone who dared to utter a word of criticism. Władysław Gomułka. In the Comintern. The purge also operated abroad and against foreigners in the USSR. The most obviously purgeable of the latter were the foreign communists and the apparatus of the Comintern. It was more particularly the communist parties which were illegal in their own countries that bore the brunt. First of all, their leaderships were mainly ready to hand in Moscow. Then again, there was no democratic opinion back in Germany or Yugoslavia or Italy which could raise objections. There were almost no victims, even in Moscow, among British or American communists, who were thus not called upon to run the risks, either at home or in Russia, which the rest of the Comintern parties had to face. Their protection derived from the nature of the regimes they were working to overthrow. Lenin, in creating the Comintern, skimmed off a lively section of the European revolutionary left, which might have otherwise fertilized a broad and unified movement and barred the way to fascism. It became instead a set of parties founded strictly on the Bolshevik model, and constitutionally subordinated to the Comintern, which always remained under effective Soviet control. After a while, these parties' leaderships were selected and their tactics dictated by Moscow, almost invariably with disastrous results. The last flicker of independence in the Comintern took place in May 1927. In the presence of Stalin, Rykov, Bukharin, and Manuelsky, the executive committee of the Comintern was asked by Thalman to condemn a document of Trotsky's on the Chinese question. All present were prepared to do so, when the Italian delegates, Togliatti and Cilone, said that they had not seen the document. It turned out that no one else had either. The Italians objected that though Trotsky was doubtless wrong, they could hardly be expected to subscribe to a formal condemnation of something they had not seen. It was explained to them that the Soviet Politburo thought it inexpedient to circulate it. The session was adjourned so that the old Bulgarian communist Kolarov could go over the question with the recalcitrant Italians in private. He told them quite frankly that it was not a question of getting at the truth, but of the struggle for power. The Comintern must go along with the Soviet Politburo majority, and that was all there was to it. The Italians still persisted in their attitude, and Stalin typically withdrew the motion. This appeal to independent judgment was, however, the last. Cilone left the party. Togliatti must have decided that his choice was of submitting to Stalin and hoping to exert some influence, or going under. He chose the former course, and persisted in it, as an accomplice in many a far grosser breach of confidence, in later years. Henceforward, the Comintern, after the removal, at that time peaceable, of various supporters of Trotsky and Bukharin, became merely another element in Stalin's political machine. As early as 1930, a member of the Yugoslav Politburo observed that apart from men of limited intelligence like Pyatnitsky and Remmel, the Comintern leaders appeared to him to be men at one time remarkable, but now demoralized or exhausted. The Comintern and its organs were by the nature of their work particularly liable to the charge of contact with foreign countries. The Communist Party of the Western Ukraine, which had been kept organizationally separate from the Communist Party of Poland, was already being purged as a nest of spies in the late 1920s. In 1936, a purge took place in the Communist Party of Latvia in which numbers of the party's leadership then in Moscow were repressed for treachery and treason. This amounted to in effect the dissolution of the party. The Latvian party had been little more than a branch of the Soviet party, in earlier times, even officially so, though many Latvians, like Rudzutak, were prominent in Russia, and their origin was used against them. The Estonian Communist Party, too, was denounced as compromised. So few Estonian communists survived that on the Soviet annexation of their country in 1940, one of the highest posts went to a man of Estonian origin who had hitherto been an assistant station master in the North Caucasus. The entire Lithuanian Central Committee was also arrested and charged with working for the Lithuanian government. In any case, all this was a mere preliminary. In 1937, the storm broke over the main body of foreign communists. In the dingy quarters of the Hotel Lux, the Comintern officials led a rather bohemian existence. Full of foreigners with nowhere else to go, the hotel became something like a frontier village raided nightly by bandits. Occasionally there was trouble. One Polish communist shot down several NKVD men before he was overcome. On April 28, 1937, Heinz Neumann, former member of the German CP's Politburo, was arrested. After being one of the leading foreigners in the Canton Commune, with his friend Lomi Nagy, he had been removed from the leadership of the German Communist Party early in the 1930s, but had been working for the party in Moscow since 1935. Neumann's dark, petite, vivacious and gay? Wife describes his arrest. At 1 o'clock in the morning, three uniformed police officials and the manager of the Lux, Gurevich, himself certainly an agent, came in and roused Neumann. Forbidding the couple to speak in German, they made a long search, lasting until dawn, of his documents, taking a trunk full and 60 books of allegedly oppositionist content. When Neumann was finally taken out, he said to his wife, "Don't cry. That's enough. Get a move on, now," ordered the leader. At the door, Heinz turned and strode back, took me in his arms again and kissed me. "Cry then," he said. "There's enough to cry about. Degree." In December 1937, Neumann was removed from the Lubyanka, and he was evidently sentenced about then, since the order confiscating his goods was handed to his wife in January 1938. He seems to have been transferred to the Butyrka in the summer of 1938 and still not to have signed any confession. His wife had by then been sentenced to 5 years as a socially dangerous element. Three other members of the German Politburo disappeared at about the same time, Hermann Remmel, Fritz Schulte, and Hermann Schubert, the last arrested in July. Schubert was denounced by an Austrian woman. Communist for having mentioned Lenin's 1917 deal with the Germans in connection with Trotsky's alleged relations with the Nazis. Togliatti then managed the attack on him. Other prominent German victims included Hans Kippenberger, head of the party's military apparatus, Leo Flieg, the organizational secretary of its central committee, and Heinrich Suskind and Werner Hirsch, editors-in-chief of Rote Fahne, together with four of their assistant editors. Hirsch seems to have been saved from a Nazi prison and allowed to go to the USSR by the intervention of Goering's wife, who knew his family. Remmel is reported as going mad in camp, and always coming to blows with both guards and fellow prisoners. The veteran Hugo Eberlein had been the only genuine delegate at the conference at which the Comintern was founded. The delegates allegedly representing foreign countries were mostly just foreigners in the Soviet service. For example, Unschlicht represented Poland. Eberlein had instructions from Rosa Luxemburg to oppose the formation of the new international and did so firmly, though abstaining in the final vote. His arrest was now reported in a Swiss paper, and he gave a press conference denying it, only to be arrested the next day. He is reported as being brutally interrogated while he was suffering from asthmatic attacks in the Lefortovo prison, and to have been sentenced to 25 years. When with a group of prisoners being moved from Kotlas to Archangel, he was too ill to travel and was shot. For lesser figures any excuse served, as with Soviet citizens. One German communist was arrested for saying that the only Nazi with principles was Goebbels. This was construed as counter-revolutionary agitation. Another was accused of counter-revolutionary agitation against the Soviet state on the grounds, in any case false, of having belonged to the opposition within the German Communist Party from 1931 to 1932. A Soviet writer reports a German communist in the Butyrka in 1937 with body scars from the Gestapo and crushed fingernails from the NKVD. Several of the arrested were Jews. This did not save them from charges of fascist espionage, any more than it had Jagir. An interrogator is quoted as saying, "The Jewish refugees are Hitler's agents abroad." The German occupation of Czechoslovakia resulted in Czechs, too, being regarded as German agents. One Czech is reported as having had to confess that he became a German agent early in the First World War, at a time when neither Czechoslovakia nor the Soviet Union existed. Willy Mienzenberg, the German Communist Party's propaganda genius, was summoned to Moscow to share the fate of Flieg, who had been arrested as he stepped off the train on arrival from Paris, as is also reported of Eberlein. One or the other was evidently the leading German communist who was brought in precisely these circumstances, to Ivanov Razumnik's cell in the Butyrka, in his neat Western suit. Horrified to learn from those present that he was, of course, a Nazi spy, Mienzenberg refused to go and was expelled from the party in 1938. He was in France and was interned at the outbreak of war in the following year. When the refugee camps were opened by the French in view of the Nazi advance in 1940, Mietzenberg struck for the Swiss border with another inmate. A few days later, his body was found in a forest near Grenoble, hanging from a tree. His face was battered, and reports make it clear that suicide is unlikely. After the Nazi-Soviet Pact, in 1939, about 570 German communists were assembled in the Moscow prisons. A number of them were sentenced by the Russians, but the majority were told that they had been judged by a special commission of the NKVD and expelled as undesirable aliens. These German communists, who included Jews and men especially wanted by the Nazis for armed resistance to them during the street fights of the early 1930s, were hustled over the bridge to German-occupied Poland at Brest-Litovsk, while NKVD men checked the lists with Gestapo men. They included the widow of Erich Mietzem, the poet, and the composer Hans David, a Jew eventually gassed by the Gestapo in the Majdanek concentration camp. The actress Caroline Ayer, who was originally on the list, disappeared in Russia instead. She was sentenced to 10 years but is believed, according to a recent Soviet article, to have been shot in Orel in 1941. Her son had been taken from her, and only found out his parents' names in the late 1960s. The son of Ernst Torgler, the main German defendant at the Leipzig trial, who had been communist leader in the Reichstag, was then about 13. He appeared at protest meetings in the West and eventually went to Russia. There he got a long sentence as a German spy. He was reported at a camp in the Komi area in the far north, where he had the job of disposing of bodies. He had by this time become completely assimilated into the young criminal element. After the Nazi-Soviet Pact, he too was handed over to the Gestapo with the other German communists. The Hungarian losses were also heavy. They included Béla Kun, leader of the 1919 communist revolution in Hungary, himself. His conduct of the terror in Budapest preceded even worse actions when, on fleeing to Moscow, he was put in charge of the newly conquered Crimea, and was censured and withdrawn by Lenin for his excessive cruelties. He then operated in the Comintern, and had been partly responsible for the communist fiasco in Germany in 1921. He has been described as the incarnation of intellectual inadequacy, uncertainty of will, and authoritarian corruption. A meeting of the Executive Committee of the Comintern in May 1937 saw his fall. Manuelsky made a speech violently denouncing him for insulting behavior to Stalin and contacts with Romanian secret police since 1919. The other members of the XI looked on in silence. Kuhn, who was quite unprepared for the attack, went white. He roared like a mortally wounded lion, "This is a terrible provocation, a conspiracy to get me murdered. But I swear that I have not wanted to insult Comrade Stalin. I want to explain everything to Comrade Stalin himself." But everything had been set up in advance. As Kuhn, pale and shocked, left the room in a dead silence, two NKVD men escorted him out. But he was not arrested immediately. A few days later, Stalin telephoned and gaily asked Kuhn to receive a French reporter and refute a rumor of Kuhn's arrest. This he did, the denial was published, and he was arrested soon afterwards. He had had several members of his own Politburo arrested earlier. Béla Kuhn was taken to the Lefortovo, where he was tortured. He is reported as having been kept standing on one foot for periods of from 10 to 20 hours. When he returned to his cell after interrogation, his legs were swollen and his face was so black as to be unrecognizable. He was in the same cell as Mukhlovich. He was then held in the Butyrka until his execution for espionage, as an agent of Germany since 1916, and of Britain since 1926. This took place on August 29, 1938. It seems clear that the formalities were complied with, for he is described as having been sentenced on the basis of a faked indictment. Kuhn's frail wife, Irma, was arrested on February 23, 1938, and got 8 years, going first to Kalima. But survived and was eventually released. His son-in-law, the Hungarian poet Hidas, was also sent to a labor camp. Of the other leaders of the Hungarian Revolution of 1919, 12 more people's commissars of the then communist government in Budapest were arrested. These included the Grand Old Man of Hungarian Communism, Dezső Bakanyi, and Joseph Pogany, known under the name of John Pepper as the Comintern's representative to the American Communist Party. Of the 12, two survived imprisonment. Theorists like Lajos Magyar also perished. Many Italian communists died, such as Edmondo Peluso, who had been with Newman in the Canton Commune. He got a letter out of prison begging friends for help and saying that his strength was failing through torture, but that they should believe his innocence. Because this was suspected to be a police trap, there was no response. The few who were later released found that their stories of prison were not believed. Togliatti's brother-in-law Paoli Rabodi was arrested in 1937. The torturers broke his teeth and incurably injured his spine, but he was eventually released and was later, in 1961, to say that he had kept silent about all this because it was not the business of Italian, but of Soviet, communists to speak. Few had Rabodi's luck. Most of the actual leadership was protected by Togliatti's docility in the face of Stalin's line. But about 200 Italian communists perished. Eugenia Ginsburg mentions an Italian woman communist screaming in the punishment cells of Yaroslavl on being beaten and hosed down with icy water. Gorkach, the general secretary of the Yugoslav Communist Party, was arrested in Moscow in the summer of 1937. His Polish wife had already been seized as a British agent. Almost the whole of the Yugoslav Central Committee followed him, together with a large number of the remaining Yugoslav communists. Of these, more than 100 found their death in Stalin's prisons and camps. They included such men as Vlada Kopisic, the party's organizational secretary, newly back from command in the International Brigade in Spain. Tito came to Moscow at this time and lived on the fourth floor of the Lux. He later said that he never knew whether he would get out alive or awake in the night to hear the fatal knocking at my door. He noticed that there was a tendency in the Comintern to dissolve the entire Yugoslav party, as was being done with the Polish and Korean parties. Finally, he was allowed to form a new central committee. As soon as he could, he transferred it to Yugoslavia and Western Europe, where it had some chance of survival. The then first secretary of the Finnish Communist Party, Arvo Tuominen, gives a long list of Finnish leaders shot, and says that nearly all Finns then living in the Soviet Union were labeled enemies of the people. These Finnish communists were involved through a confession obtained from Otto Wilm, gained by Stalinist beating methods. They were spies in the service of France, Germany, Norway, and so on. Of those not shot but sent to camp, most died. The one woman member of the Finnish Politburo drowned herself in a stream in the Salavki prison area. The tiny Romanian party lost many of its most prominent members, including Marcel Pauker, not to be confused with the NKVD officer trademark and Alexandra Dobrogeanu, shot on December 4, 1937. Pauker himself is said to have been accused of collusion with Zinoviev and shot without trial. But in general, it was the early connection of the Romanians with Rakovsky which proved fatal. Little reference seems to have been made to this micro-purge until, at the trial in Bucharest in 1952 of the Politburo member Vasile Luca, an attack was made on the treasonable clique of Marcel Pauker. Trademark Bulgarian communists were also much persecuted. Dimitrov's fellow defendants at the Leipzig trial, Tony, and Popov, were jailed. Popov survived and was rehabilitated in 1955. Chervenkov, later to be the Stalinist ruler of Bulgaria, hid in Dimitrov's flat until interceded for. There were many other victims. One Bulgarian is mentioned in a Vologda camp being thrown into a hole in the ground without food for 13 days, and dying. A recent Bulgarian article tells us that more than 1,000 of the 1,200 to 1,400 Bulgarian political emigres in the USSR found themselves in forced labor camps, and only about 100 of them came back to Bulgaria. The main leadership, such men as Ilkrov, Lambrev, and Vasilov, were Nazi or Bulgarian spies. Exiles settled in the Ukraine were charged with a plot to annex that country to Bulgaria. And so it was with all the emigre groups. For example, Tanaka, a leader of the Japanese Communist Party, was put through the conveyor and torture and as reported liquidated. But the heaviest casualties fell on the Poles. The Polish Communist Party was very much a special case in its relations with Moscow. It derived in the main from the Social Democratic Party of the Kingdom of Poland and Lithuania admitted on a basis of autonomy, together with the Jewish Bund and the Lettish Social Democrats, into the 5th Congress of the Russian Social Democrats in 1906, when the Mensheviks and Bolsheviks were still technically united. A. Swarsky and Dzerzhinsky were then elected members of the Joint Central Committee as its representatives. The Poles on the whole backed the Bolsheviks, though with reservations. Their leader Rosa Luxemburg had written privately that the Bolsheviks' support would be valuable in spite of their Tartar-Mongolian savagery. Although Lenin was soon involved in organizing factions in the Polish party, and in a series of polemics with Rosa Luxemburg and others, the quarrels were domestic in a sense which was not true of the relations with other foreign organizations. There was much coming and going between the parties, then and later. When Poland became an independent state, Poles who had worked with the Bolsheviks and remained on Soviet soil became members of the Russian Communist Party pure and simple. We have only to think of names like Dzerzhinsky, Radek, Menzinski, and Unschlicht, as with the parallel Lettish cases of Ike, Rudzutak, and others. A Pole could be transferred between the new Communist Party of Poland and the Russian Communist Party at will. Marchlewski, named head of the Polish government established behind the Red Army lines during the 1920 invasion of Poland, became, after the debacle, a Soviet diplomat. As a natural corollary, the Polish Party, insofar as its organizations within